Hi there. You're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3. Earlier this month, the Hamilton Community Foundation published its report, Vital Signs. It revealed some encouraging signs of economic progress, but also highlighted grave inequities that persist in the city of Hamilton. The report found that child poverty rates are over 50% in several neighborhoods, and that emergency food bank use continues at pre-recession levels. I want to focus on one particular finding of the report, though, that the city's social assistance caseloads are at a 10-year high. We've talked before about the insufficiency of the current social assistance rates in Ontario and about the link between poverty and health. There persists, however, a certain attitude within our society that those on social assistance are taking the easy way out, that they're somehow lazy, and that they got themselves into this in the first place, didn't they? On today's episode of the Health Justice Radio Collective, we confront those misconceptions as I speak with Laura, an advocate and member of the Hamilton Roundtable on Poverty Reduction.
Listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, I brought up a topic, and that is misconceptions surrounding social assistance. So, I wonder if you can maybe tell us a bit about your story and tell us about how those misconceptions affect you.
Well, to start off with, I guess my background would be helpful. I started out a lot like most of you, hoping for a really great future. I had a really great income, looking probably $80K a year. I had savings. I had RSPs. I was saving for a house. And I thought everything was going great. I worked for a company as a consultant, project manager. And my company was in the process of being taken over by another company. At the same time, I was starting to get ill. And I found myself laid off as my illness progressed to a point where I knew I'd be disabled. Due to the timing, I didn't have any long-term insurance benefits, and found myself seeking the system. It was an incredibly frustrating process, very long-winded. Found myself looking at very condensed EI benefits, 17 weeks at the time. During that time, I was disbursing my assets to get rid of any debt because I knew I would be ill for a very long time. Then you get shunted to the application process for ODSP and CPP since I had been a long-time worker. Unfortunately, that process runs a lot along the lines of denial and denial before benefits are taken. I found that incredibly difficult process for a number of reasons. One, you're at a point in your life where you're ill enough that you can't work. And you're trying to find a way to cope with the paperwork and the attitude that you must be faking it. And that's incredibly demoralizing and a bit dehumanizing to face denials when you know you can't support yourself anymore. And it really does lead, in some instances, to ideas of suicidal ideation, which is incredibly perverse, really, for a program that's supposed to be assisting people in their lifestyle. Going through that was really eye-opening. To do that at the same time that I was facing radical change in my own life, losing everything I had ever worked for, losing a lot of my social set, not being able to socialize with people and keep up with the type of activities they did, was really depressing.
Can you tell me a bit more about that? What do you mean you weren't able to keep up with what they did?
Well, your income, one, radically is reduced. So you're not going out with your friends anymore and doing the same things you used to do. At the same time, your illness is precluding you from getting out and being as active as you once were. Along with that is the idea that you've lost the ability to afford internet, to afford my newspaper subscription anymore, to afford cable television. And all of a sudden you're feeling incredibly isolated and no longer a part of the flow of what you're used to. I was no longer participating. I used to be a yoga teacher, so I was no longer teaching nor doing yoga communally with other people. And it, like I said, it's an incredibly isolating process.
Mm-hmm. Sounds terrible. So I guess at the core of that is the idea that, you know, cable TV is an extravagance and that internet is an extravagance. And I guess basically like having friends and being able to, you know, grab a coffee with them is something that not everyone should be able to do.
That is the feeling you tend to get when people talk about social assistance. The way I tend to view it is that even though I may not be able to work a 40-hour work week, by keeping me happy and included in our community, it enables me to go out and do the volunteer work that a lot are not able to do anymore. We used to have one-income households where the other person, you know, once the children got to a certain age, would be able to volunteer. We've seen a decrease in that. I think by enabling people, especially with disabilities, to get out, feel productive, and feel needed in our community in some way, shape, or form is really important. So what some may consider an extravagance can become a benefit to all people if we still feel included.
Mm-hmm. Now, just going back to something you said earlier, you said that you had to sell off most of your assets in order to qualify for ODSP, is that it?
Yes. What happened, actually, in my particular case, my file got lost by EI. So I was actually living for 3 months while there was a debate between my previous employer and them and losing my file. And so I was living off of my savings, and any debt that I had, I knew I had to get rid of. And I had to basically get to less than $500 in my bank account before I could even apply for social services. The ODSP process comes much later, and so the first thing people usually hit is Ontario Works, and Ontario Works has an asset limit straight up of $500.
Okay. So maybe now would be a good time to talk about the difference between OW, Ontario Works, and ODSP, who gets one and the other.
All right. Ontario Works recipients are usually people who are job ready and through either running out of their EI or being employed in programs like contract work or temporary work, have not accumulated enough hours to go on EI. So they will go on Ontario Works, which is $5.92 a month, which is virtually impossible to live on in this city, while they're still trying to find employment. ODSP is actually the Ontario Disability Support Program. And people on disability supports actually go through minimally an 8-month to a year process of proving that they are unable to be gainfully employed, meaning we cannot work enough to sustain ourselves.
Okay. And I wonder if you can tell me a bit about how being on ODSP has affected your health.
That's I find that actually one of the most ironic things about the disability program, because dealing with my medical professionals, I'm constantly told, go home, rest, eat well, exercise moderately, and of course, no stress. And it seems the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Community and Social Services are directly at odds with each other, because the resting when you're worried about how to manage your rent and hydro and food just does not happen, as well as the eating well. And exercising moderately and getting physiotherapy costs money. Physiotherapy is no longer covered by the province. And for the type I need, it would be $600 a month, which I can't afford. ODSB is less than $1,000 a month. And of course, the no stress is virtually impossible when you're struggling to live like this. You're struggling to keep a positive attitude towards life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does seem that they're almost exactly at odds with each other. So, I mean, I'm curious, what do your health professionals do when you tell them, you know, it's just not possible?
Most of them are fairly sympathetic.
Okay.
There have been a few that I've seen in reports come back from specialists that I'm non-compliant, which is a bit difficult to swallow from my end. I would love to comply with my doctors and do exactly what they wish me to do. I would love to be healthy again. I would love to get to a point where I could work part-time and feel better at that. Actually, what started me on my path to advocacy was trying self-employment and looking at a cash flow statement and looking at the rules of ODSP and realizing after my 50% reductions from income, I would never break the poverty line, even if I did work. And I mean, I'm trying self-employment. But it's incredibly discouraging to be in a system that doesn't allow me to get ahead in any way, shape, or form.
Can you tell us about your work on the Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction? How did you come to be involved in that?
Well, at the same time, I saw my first cash flow statement while I was creating a business plan. And within 24 hours, I saw an ad come up for the roundtable saying that they were looking for new members. And I thought, something has to change, and I might as well put myself forward and see what I could do. And the roundtable is currently actually has a working group for social assistance reform in Ontario. And I signed right up for the working group. We had the commissioners here last July speaking to us about things that need changing. Of course, the rates are one of our number one issues, but there are a lot of other issues around job training and retraining, about affordable housing, and simplifying the rules. I found when I went through the process of applying, my own doctor was as mystified as I was in the questions being asked. And I think simplifying the process so that doctors and social workers, caseworkers in the system can all understand and agree on the meaning of things would actually help a lot. And of course, communication is primary there.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, like, more broadly what the Hamilton Roundtable on Poverty Reduction does?
I'm glad you asked, because I've found a few times this past weekend people weren't sure. We're not a service provider. The Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction is actually a community collaborative. It brings people together from multiple sectors, including different levels of government, community agencies that do provide services, people from health, public health is actually involved in it, as well as people with lived experience. And we're looking to bring in different sectors again as we move forward, trying to build community consensus around the issue of social assistance.
So how did the conversations that you said you had with the commissioners earlier this year, how did those go?
They actually went quite well. We were actually lauded as a community and, you know, pat on the back, clap to us that we are one of the few communities in Ontario that has a really strong collaborative, that have people active and engaged in our community, which is really great. They've asked us to come back with a broader consensus to include business and just the general public. And so clearing up what we're doing today, clearing up some of the myths around social assistance and even the cost of social assistance would be really helpful.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about what social assistance reform would look like?
Well, at this point, we've put through the recommendations. I had just mentioned what our working group is working on. We are waiting just the beginning of November is supposed to be the commissioners coming back to us with recommendations or a brief on what they've heard across Ontario and what they've found in their research. And then we'll have community discussions again. And I'm hoping with those recommendations that we can come to some sort of acceptable solutions from both sides on being accountable to the public, which I think is important, but also creating a system that isn't costing them $32 to $38 billion, as the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario mentioned pre-election, that it was costing in healthcare-related poverty costs, both private and public sector. And we're spending $6.6 billion on social assistance, so there has to be some trade-off, and I'm really hoping that's what's going to happen when the commissioners come back to us.
Can you talk about some specific recommendations that you guys made, other than obviously raising the rates?
The specific recommendations were actually to create an easier system, less rules. I know less rules sounds funny, but you have to realize there are 800 directives for Ontario Works and the Ontario Disability Supports Program. There's no way that any one person is going to remember 800 rules at one time. Mm-hmm. Again, with training, actually providing adequate training that reflects what is needed out in the labor force at the moment, providing adequate housing or shelter benefits, affordable housing. And lastly, but not least, communication. There are a lot of people going through the system that have language barriers, whether it be to developmental or mental health issues, or just straight up interpretive language issues. And I think better communication, the easier access to be able to discuss things, perhaps advocacy for those less able to speak for themselves in the process, all those things become really important.
You mentioned 800 rules. Can you give us some examples of some of those?
Wow, 800 rules. The 800 rules, I don't even know where to start at this moment. Some of them contradict themselves, like a rule, income rules, that you're not allowed certain forms of income and that you have to declare them, but they come from other government sources, so they end up being deducted. So one program is trying to benefit the same group of people, but it ends up being deducted. So really, they end up no further ahead. Ontario Child Benefit is actually one of my favorite ones. As soon as that was implemented, they reduced the amounts for children by $179 on across the board. So children of people either on Ontario Works or ODSP received less, But then through some weird income calculation, not everyone's receiving the same amount of the Ontario Child Benefit. So I'm a little off track there, but it's a lot of working against each other. And one of my personal hopes is that different ministries will begin to actually work collaboratively together so that all the programs actually do have the benefit that they were intended to have.
Mm-hmm. So you said that the Hamilton, the Roundtable on Poverty Reduction, you know, is it quite a mix of people who have lived experience and people who are in health, people who are in government. What's it like when people meet you and hear your story, and what's that like for you?
It's an odd process. It ends up being incredibly liberating. It's a little nervous at first. There is fear of stigma and not being accepted as an equal, or maybe I'll be too radical about it. But at the same time, being able to tell my story and being able to tell people, hey, I'm you, and a social assistance program that wouldn't meet your needs isn't something you should be allowing for someone else. And, you know, I never expected to be here. And I really hope no one else ends up being here. I mean, I hope everyone enjoys good health and, you know, has great benefits and doesn't have to worry about things like that. But no one plans to be here. And so being able to tell people that and be honest about it, there's a bit of a healing process in that.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly been powerful for me to hear your story, and I'm sure for everyone else who hears your story. But also, not everyone is like you. I mean, everyone on ODSP presumably has their own story and their own journey. So what also has it been like to meet other people?
It's been really incredible. Even though I've lived with illness for 8 years, to hear what brings people to disability and my own understanding of what disability is. I think, like a lot of people, I thought disability was a mobility aid. It's something you physically saw when you met someone. But my understanding now, you know, these are people that have cardiac illness that have not recovered as well as other people might. Cancer survivors whose immune systems and energy have never returned to what it once was. And these are people, unlike myself, that are raising families that this has happened to, and their experiences with trying to go back to work and not getting the supports they need. It's dispelled a lot of my own myths. What I thought I knew what illness was or disability was has changed radically.
I think that's all the time we have for today, and I just want to thank you so much for sharing your story. And before we go, I mean, we have a bit of time. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about?
I would really love to ask your audience and your viewers, this is the air, your audience to consider contacting either myself through advocacyhamilton.com or their own MPs and asking them to support social assistance reform, and especially in the medical community, to actually make their jobs easier and help them in their own goals of helping other people.
Okay. Thank you, Laura, so much for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.